the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as military bases and chemical plants may be advised to evacuate.
Welcome, Sublation viewers. It's I, Douglas Lane, author of Bash Bash Revolution, head honcho at Sublation Media, and resident dissident contrarian.
And I'm Ashley Farrelly. I'm a sociologist at the University of Kent, second honcho at Sublation Media, columnist at Compact Mag, and many other affiliations. Can't think of, visiting researcher at MCC Brussels. And selling my soul daily. No, I'm kidding. So this week we wanted to talk about, following Sublation Media. We want to talk about a very good article that appeared in Sublation Magazine called "The Left Cannot Make Use of the Gaza War" by Benjamin Studebaker. And it basically argues that the left has more or less abandoned its, at least the American left has more or less abandoned some of its bread and butter domestic policies that had characterized the 2010s, the enthusiasm over Bernie Sanders, and has thrown all in for Gaza. And Studebaker says that this is a mistake. That, well, I don't know if we want to go through the overall argument or go through it piece by piece, but essentially, Studebaker says that, people used to care about healthcare. Housing. I'm not sure to what extent people don't care about those things anymore, but they're certainly not the headline issues for which people are kind of, sitting outside and occupying space for. And instead, they've kind of gone all in behind what he characterizes as an ethno-nationalist blueprint set by the right, where you have these two sides that have staked an ethnic claim on land, and the left has taken one of these sides. And this, he argues, reifies ethnicity and is essentially useless. Most Americans don't care about the issue, about Gaza, at least not as much as they cared about Iraq. And by giving Biden essentially a pass on everything, because they said, well, Trump is the worst enemy and nothing is worse than Trump, by voting for Biden, we are opposing fascism. It doesn't really matter what Biden does in terms of economic policy. So they've kind of abandoned economic critique. And if you abandon economic critique, then you kind of allow the right to frame economics. And when they frame economic issues, they scapegoat. And so they scapegoat immigrants. And that's kind of where we are now, where anybody who's economically disaffected has nowhere to go. They're not going to vote for Biden. So where they're they've lost them, and they've allowed this kind of immigration as the problem frame to run amok. And this is a terrible mess in which we found ourselves in, and yet we are doubling down and going all in on Gaza. Have I more or less characterized the argument correctly?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I have some excerpts from it that I pulled out that I could read. I also just put a link to it in the description for this live stream. I realized I hadn't done that. Yeah, he says too much of the American left has accepted the ethno-nationalist ontology of Palestinians and Israelis. If there are two national peoples, each of which believes it is entitled to a state of its own on the same territory, what are these people to do but fight until one overcomes the other? How does it help to champion one ethno-nationalism against the other? Sorry, so I had to cough there.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
So we can kind of focus in on that particular issue. I got into a lot of trouble a while back for saying that radical decolonization is woke fascism. And again, as I said, people don't really understand rhetoric and framing. So I wasn't saying like woke people are going to don jackboots and goose step through the streets, that sort of thing. But that it is essentially accepting this frame that there is there are people that lay legitimate claim to an area and everyone else should get out. And everyone always says like, oh no, it's decolonization is just a metaphor. Yeah, it's a metaphor when it suits you and it's not when it doesn't. So that was the response that I got. Oh, I thought it was just about like changing our curricula in universities. Oh, silly me, a sort of sarcastic response. And then October 7th happened and people were saying, well, what did you think decolonization was? Was it just a metaphor? Clearly it wasn't, And so he's sort of taking that line and he's saying, what we're doing here is we are accepting this frame that ethno-nationalism matters and that one group does have legitimate claim. And if that's the case, then how do you deal with these things? You just kind of let each group fight it out. But he says there is another solution, and that is a two-state solution. But he says this isn't realistic. So you can have, okay, if it's ethno, if you want to have ethno states, then maybe, and you don't want to, you know, banish all the current Israelis from that piece of land, then you can have a two-state solution. But he says there's not enough Palestinian territory to have a Palestinian state. And he also goes on to argue that actually, when you kind of cede, as colonized people around the world know, if you cede territory and you allow people to self-govern, it's not real. Like, most people don't really self-govern. He says it's a chimera.
Yeah, I mean, the point he's making here is that the Gaza protests are aimed at backing the Palestinian struggle for independence from Israel, and they seem to be embracing a two-state solution, at least, or a one-state solution where what is now Israel becomes Palestine. That's like the maximum position. There is another side to the protest movement, which is that it is a protest aimed at pressuring the Biden administration to defund Israel, or to use the threat of defunding to change the Israeli course and change and basically put a leash on the Israeli war machine. I think there are a lot of pundits and commentators who are pro-Palestine and pro the Palestinian protests who would take that position, that the point of the protests is to create a pressure for a ceasefire and for the defunding of the Israeli war machine. But we should note that is the minimum position, and it seems that, from what I've heard on college campuses, that the maximum position is what is rhetorically useful, is what people are motivated by, or the kind of chants that they chant are for that maximal position. So I do think that Studebaker's critiques and his characterization is fairly accurate, despite the fact that you could see the protests as basically reformist in its mission and rather moderate in its demands. So I'll let you respond to that.
By that, you mean that the maximal position is fairly moderate? Is fairly moderate, and in that it's sort of saying a two-state solution.
Well, no, that's not the maximal position. The maximal position is one-state solution. Israeli Jews out of Israel, that becomes Palestine. That's the maximal position. The minimal position, right, is not even states. It's just no funding for the Israelis' war machine and a ceasefire. That's the minimal position. And I think that's really as far as most people have been thinking, because there is no peace process. There are no terms for a settlement that could create two states, that there's no one even to negotiate with, meaning that the Hamas really won't negotiate with Israel, as far as I can tell. And certainly the Israelis seem to have no willingness to negotiate with Hamas. The Palestinian Authority does not have the authority to negotiate. They can't restrain Hamas fighters. So, you know, there's no process in place for a resolution that could stick. All we can demand is a ceasefire at the moment, it seems, and or a defunding of the Israeli military from, you know, to basically not a completely defunding, but just keeping U.S. money out of Israel. Of course, that demand has already been ignored. They just last Saturday passed a $92 billion spending bill for Ukraine and Israel. So these protests are arising after the fact. So their demand has been cast aside. There was no political force within the government, either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, to stop the funding of both wars, Ukraine and Israel. So at this point, that seems to be a fait accompli. That doesn't seem to be an option. I've been hearing on Twitter that there is hope for the direct action of protest to become more extreme forms, to morph into more extreme forms of direct action, maybe blockades, trying to stop the shipment of arms, things along those lines, which are all tactics that we've seen, you know, for the last 50 years. I know a man who's was participating in a blockade to stop the shipment of nuclear arms and laid in on railroad tracks and got his legs severed.
Oh my God.
Because the train didn't stop fast enough, I guess. So he was hit and lost both legs. But he's still out there. I mean, it's as far as I know, it's been about a decade since I've seen him or talked to him, but he may be gone now because, you know, people age, but he's not gone from the railroad, the rail accident. And he continued on to struggle against the U.S. state for years and years. He was a Vietnam vet. Anyhow, this is a longstanding tradition on the American left to try direct actions to stop the military from engaging in violent, genocides or bombings of civilians or what have you. The whole list of atrocities that the U.S. military has been responsible for has been protested for a long time.
If we go back to your minimalist kind of position, trying to stop funding, that sort of thing, you know, Studebaker says that this is not going to work because there's no pressure that these groups can really put on Biden, since it's clear they're not going to vote for anyone else. They've already kind of, and I, you know, when I read that, I kind of thought about why Hillary Clinton wanted Trump in office initially, because first of all, she thought he would be easy to win against. But he's such a caricature that it just seemed like, you know, voting against him would be better than voting for somebody. You know, it's more alluring than voting for somebody. And I wondered, you know, I thought, well, Biden must really love the idea of Trump getting into office, because they framed it as like a choice for democracy versus fascism. So if you want to like save the world as we know it, then you better vote Biden. And so, you know, by accepting that dichotomy, they've basically said, look, you know, there's nothing that you can do that's going to stop us from voting you in. The real people that Biden needs to worry about are the people who are disaffected by things like economic policy, where by Biden's own economic policy, and where there isn't really any alternative to that. And so that kind of pressure, at least, isn't likely to work, because Biden knows he has them firmly on his side. At least that's the argument that Studebaker makes.
Yeah, that's Studebaker's argument. You know, that was the part of the piece that I was least convinced by, not because I think that there is an alternative electoral choice for people who are against the funding of Israel and against Israeli brutality in Gaza, but rather because I do think that in this next election, small pockets of voters, small demographic differences, couldn't be consequential. And, it, you know, it wasn't looking good for Biden even before October 7th. And I do think that the left, even some of the Bernie left or the social democratic left, has now decided that Biden needs to be punished. These protests are punishing the Biden administration. That's what they're kind of aimed to do, I think. And I think there's a good chance that a lot of the organizers, the people who are actively engaged in the pro-Palestinian movement, will refrain from voting for Biden. I don't know if that's going to be consequential, but it could be consequential if the influence of that group moves enough young people to not vote for Biden. And I've heard that Donald Trump is even gaining among younger voters, like that's been traditionally a Democratic demographic. And it seems that there's a realignment happening and young voters are turning to Trump, maybe not in huge numbers, but more than would be expected.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time that conflict has pushed people toward the right, so when there isn't any avenue to express dissent, people will, you know, you've had this happen before, where the right wing will pose or put themselves up as the anti-war, anti-military party, at least on this particular conflict. And that's happened with Ukraine and other countries as well. But I don't know what Trump's position is, because he just sort of speaks out of both sides of his mouth, and he just sort of comes in as like, oh, this is terrible, we're going to get out of these conflicts and da da da. And then he's like, we never seem to go to war anymore. That sounds like fun.
He also is like, just a few days ago, was saying that he was at a rally and people behind him started chanting, "Genocide Joe, Genocide Joe." And he was like, well, you know, they're not wrong. They're not wrong.
Oh, yes.
And then today he's tweeting out, "Stop the protesters. Clear the universities." So, you know, he certainly is capable and consistently does have it both ways all the time.
Yeah, I mean, for all the wailing about fascism, that is pretty Hitler-esque, sort of like man for all seasons kind of thing. Well, I'll say one thing to the workers, and I'll say one thing to the businesses, and I'll say one. Anyways, the other thing that
he says all these things to everyone on Twitter. He just tweets out whatever the hell hits his mind. He doesn't filter for one group or another, or maybe he does. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, as his whims sort of dictate. He's like, no, I don't like this. No, I'm sure there's some underlying logic. Anyways, but I can't remember who it was that I interviewed on my podcast, and they were saying that what Trump does is he brands people's grievances, that he doesn't really stand for anything, but what he offers is a branding. So if your group feels that you can't get a voice or you can't get your particular issue onto the political agenda, he's like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. I'll slap the Trump logo on it, you know, and you vote for me, I'll give you the Trump logo. Same thing as like, you know, give me this money, I'll give you the Trump logo. That's kind of his modus operandi. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I found interesting about the I wasn't sure about with the article, among a few other things, is he compares the public polling in relation to Iraq with the public polling for Gaza, and he says, you know, Iraq mobilized an enormous amount of the population. You know, a lot of people were not. It was an issue that affected, or seemed to affect, or people across all walks of life cared about. And it was something that the left cared about. And he says, well, we shouldn't really tail polls or anything like that. But it's interesting that the left is thrown all in when, I can't remember what the percentages are, it's something like 30% point to an explicitly, only 2% of Americans point to a war in the Middle East as the most important issue at the moment. 30% point to an explicitly economic issue, while a further 28% raise immigration. And he talks about immigration as like this concern for immigration being a result of the fact that the left has ceded economics to the right. They're not really talking about economics. And when you allow the right to frame economic issues, they'll scapegoat. They'll be like, oh, it's those damn immigrants, that sort of thing.
Well, the Democrats are talking about economics. They're just saying the economy is great. Stop complaining. Yeah. Why are you bothering about the economy? But go ahead.
Yeah. And then he gives a bunch of housing stats and this sort of thing. That it's really not a great situation for a lot of people. But I kind of thought he kind of frames Iraq as a domestic issue, as something that, you know, although it's foreign policy, it was domestic in the sense that, you know, the Americans are explicitly involved, that sort of thing. Whereas in this, they're just like throwing their support, supposedly. But it is. It is a domestic issue to the extent that it's something that you are throwing a shitload of money at. And it can be something on the political agenda. I mean, he admits as much in the article that part of politics is trying to put something on the political agenda. And if you don't have political representation, one of the only ways that you can try to agenda set is to create moral disorder news or disorder news, that you create an upset somewhere, you have a blockade, something like that. And that's what gets you onto the news. And that's what gets you onto the public agenda. And so I kind of thought, are we being a little bit too pessimistic? Let's take the devil's advocate position. Is that not a little bit too pessimistic, this idea that, oh, well, you know, American voters, or the American public anyway, as far as polls are concerned, they only really care about these domestic issues, and the left is out here throwing all in on this thing that no one cares about. But in a way, that's kind of the problem. That's why they're there, because nobody seems to care enough. Just sort of playing devil's advocate. I don't know what you think about that.
No, I am. Sorry, I do agree. I also got distracted for a second there. So when am I supposed to be commenting on again? Sorry.
I love how your first, you didn't hear what I said, but your first instinct is like, yes, I agree.
Well, I agree with the first half of what you said. This is terrible. We got to professionalize, and that starts with me. No, I agree that we could conceive of a left moment where the left was managed to communicate the issue about Gaza in such a way that it became something important to voters, right? But then what was your second point? That was what I missed.
Oh, I was just saying that's kind of what they're doing. That's what they're trying to do. I mean, I don't know whether or not that's my own critique, but I was saying, well, one could say that that's exactly what they're trying to do, is set the agenda in the only way they can.
I don't believe that they are trying to set the agenda. Because I don't think they have a coherent enough politics to set the agenda or to even make an effort to do that. Today, I got blocked on Twitter by Matt Leck, which I think is symptomatic of the problem with the protests. He had tweeted out, if you have a critique of the protest movement, you should make that from within the protest movement. You should go to a protest and critique it internally, not on social media, not from the comfort of your house during a genocide. Which is basically to say, if you're not a part of this movement already, you don't have the right to criticize it. We don't want to hear critical voices right now, which is to say, we don't want to think, and we don't want to respond to people who are not within our inner circle. It was born out of a passionate feeling of emergency, right? But of course, that emergency has actually behind us to a large degree, in so much as my understanding is that the worst of the violence is behind us for the moment. And then also, and this I'm more confident in, the moment where we could put pressure on the government to stop funding Israel has passed. So this seems very performative to me. I'm sorry. I know that's a right-wing thing to say, I guess, but it doesn't seem like it's aimed at a political goal, but rather is an expression of something rather than expression of an inner anxiety rather than aimed at political consequences.
Well, that's funny that you should say that, because in my most recent podcast out on my Patreon, for Patreon only, it's called Why You Should Cite Joseph Gusfield in Your Next Paper. And I did a little mini lecture on Joseph Gusfield, who's the author of, do I have the book here? This one here, Symbolic Crusade. It's one of my favorite books. And Gusfield is one of the most important but often forgotten sociologists of the 20th century, and actually into the 21st century. He died in 2015, very, very old. But this book was written in 1963. And it's about American temperance. I talk about it a lot. But one of the arguments that he makes in the book is that he makes a distinction between expressive politics and instrumental politics. And in the lecture that I have on my podcast, I go into this in a bit more detail. I'm going to post it on YouTube, the lecture bit, maybe on Thursday. Yeah. But he says instrumental politics are those aimed at some material outcome, perhaps the distribution of some valued good. And when you have a situation in which all of the big questions in society seem to be answered and you can't affect that, and there's not really much that you can do in the way of instrumental politics, instrumental politics get displaced onto expressive or symbolic politics, hence the name of the book, Symbolic Crusade. And so symbolic politics or expressive politics are about expression. They're about blowing off steam. They are a displacement activity for frustrations mm-hmm. and grievances that cannot be satisfied or met or whatever elsewhere. And so I did write as a margin note when I was reading Studebaker's article, is Gaza an example of expressive or symbolic politics, a kind of surrogate issue that expresses a frustration at the left's inability to meet other goals like dealing with healthcare at home or housing or having an effect on economic policy? Just seems like it's more of the same. And there's nothing we can do. You know, we tried, we failed. And now putting these things on the agenda in a real way seems impossible. And so these frustrations become displaced onto a conflict in which it seems everything that we could not achieve can be achieved, or at least we can express our frustration and feel as though we are doing something for something much bigger than we can at home. If that makes sense. I don't know if you see that analysis as useful.
No, I do for sure. And I think that, you know, I've been talking up to people on Twitter lately. I've been actually consciously making an effort to tweet more because I think it's a wise move just in terms of marketing and all for the channel. And but I've been engaging with the Midwestern Marxism people mm-hmm. and the some people who seem to be around them. I guess there's a guy named Hinkle who's very big right now. He's all the rage.
Yeah.
He's so hot right now.
There's a few people that I really like, one of the TSSI economists. Andrew Kleiman. He writes with Andrew Kleiman a lot.
Alan Freeman.
I really like Alan Freeman. I like his wife, Radhika Desai. I don't agree mm-hmm. with a lot of what they say, but I think they do great stuff. So, you know, I'm a fan, even though I disagree with a little bit. I'm not a tanky, that kind of thing. So
I'm not engaging with China, Alan Freeman.
But I have hope, you know, I want to believe. Anyway, go on.
So. Yeah, I'm not engaging with Alan Freeman on Twitter, so I don't know what he's saying. Right. I've heard rumors about some of his positions, but I don't know what they are. But what I would say about the people who like Midwestern Marxism, which may, again, I don't watch them regularly, so they may have done some great podcasts, but it seems to me that their sudden love of Stalin, like their outright love of Stalin, their claim that he and Putin are the new leaders of the new communist movement, these are forms of symbolic expressive politics, that the whole of it is just a kind of people would say things like they're LARPing, but I think they are looking to formulate an idea that would give them the ability to overcome the impasse that the American left has reached. And so this is this is the form that's taking. That would be what I would say about them. And that all of that does feed into the ideology of the protest movement itself. There is a background notion that, you know, what we need to defeat capitalism is a war of the East against the West, where the East wins, and the destruction of the American hegemon and the overturning of settler colonialism.
Yeah.
And that is in the background, and, you know, not always in the background.
What I meant when I was saying, go ahead. Oh, I was just gonna say that's what I meant when I was saying, like, this is it's a displacement activity onto something where we feel that we can win. And what I had in mind there was around decolonization, where it's like, oh no, it's just a metaphor. But then, you know, you have papers that are like, decolonization is not a metaphor. and it's mm-hmm. a metaphor whenever we feel like it, but it's a metaphor because there's nothing really we can do about it. In the USA, there's no going back. So you had all these people that were living through October 7th as a kind of catharsis for their own guilt. You know, the famous one, the tweet that we like to go back to as though it's indicative of everything. But this woman was like, yeah, you know, if the native people came and decided to shoot us all up, I'd cower in a hole, but I'd be like, yeah, you know, I deserve it kind of thing. And, you know, I've got a friend who's constantly, I don't spend any time on TikTok. I tried my best, but it's depressing. But I've got a friend who spends a lot of time on TikTok and the left there, and he's constantly sending me things like, people are like, well, I'd gladly go back to Italy, you know, it's nice there, this kind of thing. People are like sort of self-flagellating, but they all know it's a fantasy. There's nothing we can do about it. We're marked with this original sin, but we can kind of go through these motions and absolve ourselves of those sins. Now, I am a little bit reluctant to head too far down the path of this critique. I kind of rehearsed it. I said, well, when I was reading the article, I thought to myself, is this a kind of symbolic or expressive politics? Now, the important thing to understand that when something is symbolic or expressive politics doesn't mean there's no real problem. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a real problem, but the importance that we give to it in relation to what we can actually do about it kind of speaks to the fact that it becomes symbolic for us. So this is the tricky thing to understand. Like, there are all sorts of things that you can understand as forms of expressive politics or symbolic politics. Like, for the right and the left, really, obesity is something you could analyze. The obesity issue is something you could analyze from that angle. Like, for the left, now you have like this sort of like pro-fat movement and that kind of thing. But for the left, obesity for a long time was a way of getting at a critique of capitalist corporations, this sort of thing. So for them, it was symbolic of, you know, big business and this kind of thing poisoning us, and this a kind of deeper cultural distrust of bigness, a discomfort with getting something so intimate as food from a corporation, all of these things that get expressed through the body of a fat person. And it doesn't mean that there's not a real problem there. And it doesn't mean that obesity isn't actually a health risk, but the outsized importance, the desire to inflate and to take and to not be at all critical of the most inflated statistics, like the elision of overweight and obesity. For instance, overweight is actually, if you look at your odds of dying or morbidity and mortality, you want to be overweight. That's a sweet spot. And then obesity is where you have the higher that you get to the ends, the very, very fat and the very, very thin people. That's where your bad health outcomes are concentrated. But you kind of, and there aren't that many people at both ends there. But if you allied overweight and obesity, you get a big number. And then you take the risk for the people at the end and you democratize that for the whole group. Mm-hmm. People are completely not critical of that sort of thing because it is an expression for them. It expresses something. I knew it was wrong. I knew there was something wrong in the world. And that stat just tells me exactly how wrong it really is. And then for the right, obesity was symbolic of the decline of moral standards. Women weren't cooking proper nutritious food in the home anymore. They were taking their kids out for fast food. They were neglecting their motherly duties. So it became this kind of, you could not say anymore. It was no longer socially acceptable to say, like, ladies, get back into your kitchens. But you could talk about obesity and about the, you know, the harm to children. And you could make that same critique in a kind of veiled way. So then this became a symbolic crusade. Obesity became a symbolic crusade that spoke to people on both the left and the right for various reasons. Now you have like the whole body acceptance movement that plays out similar kinds of things. But these doesn't mean there's no real problem there. But the importance that we give it expresses all of our all sorts of frustrations.
And RFK Jr. has actually been speaking to this issue in this current election cycle, as one other way to understand, you know, his politics, which are anti-corporate and anti-vaccine and anti-bureaucracy. So, you know, he uses the obesity issue to indict the current state of affairs as well. But I would say that, yeah, to claim that the protests are expressive is almost redundant, because what we're talking about is a moment where the politics of the social democratic moment, the politics that were really defined by the Bernie Sanders campaign, but also the support for the Squad and the attempting to change Democratic Party's character, has now given way to a return to issue-oriented protest movements that I think hide from politics. that isn't to say that I have an easy solution, and only if only these people weren't so stupid and they did X instead of Y, this wouldn't be happening, right? I'm just saying we should at least note that despite how horrible the massacre in Gaza is, despite how completely unacceptable the U.S. foreign policy has been over the last 4 years, you know, the brutality of the U.S. empire is undeniable. But despite how the, you know, how bad the problem is, that does not mean that our own actions are necessarily correct just because the sentiment behind them, what they're expressing, is correct. So, and when we, like Matt Leck, say, if you want to critique this movement, you better do it from within the Columbia University Library rather than on Twitter. When you say that kind of thing, what you're really saying is, I don't want to think. I know that seems hyperbolic, but I do think that's the underlying message. It's wrapped in a kind of moralism. You know, people who critique desktop warriors are critiquing from comfort, and we're out here risking confrontations with the police. How dare you critique us? But nonetheless, you know, there's such a thing as the division of labor. There are people who've been thinking about these things for a long time. and there's just the fact that not being involved gives you critical distance. So you should be more open to you should be more open to criticism that and to deny and to outright say you should not be critical unless you are there. I think is a kind of a reflexive authoritarian move. And I'm not saying this about Matt Leck because I want to single him out. I think it is reflective of an overall sentiment and not just his personal opinion. And I'm sure he may change it over time, but go ahead.
I mean, that said, like, I am a little bit uncomfortable with critiquing movements. Like, you know,
why?
Okay. First of all, I want to say that critique is necessary for forward movement. So there's that. Someone wrote in the comments just now, I'm sick of hearing about problems. Can we have solutions? I want to come back to that because I think that's how we get into the predicament that we're in right now. That's such a like a managerial kind of, no offense, Dan. I know that's not what you mean, but I hear echoes of things like, you know, at a meeting with managers, they're like, I don't want you to bring me problems. I want you to bring me solutions. We're a solutions-oriented company. But if you really want to solve a problem, you do need to think really deeply about what the problem is. You need to have a mind for kind of digging through all of the different frames. And it's kind of what we're trying to do right now is we're trying to think of like, well, how else might we think about this issue? Regardless of whether or not I think this is how it should be understood, it's kind of opening up our brains a little bit and saying like, well, how else could we frame this? Why are we being invited to frame it in this particular way? I.e. as an ethno-nationalist conflict between two ethnic groups who have a legitimate, one of which has a legitimate claim to land we should throw ourselves behind, for example. Okay, So there is a certain role for critique. On the other hand, I do think people have a point that if you want to, I don't know. I'm thinking on my feet at the moment. If you want to kind of build something and build a movement, I don't know, you kind of got to get out and take risks. You do. And that risk taking, that impulse to do that, I think is really admirable. And if there had been, if there was some kind of organization that was meaningful, you would hope that we would not sit on the sidelines and say, well, isn't this just blah, blah, blah? And aren't those young kids just X, Y, Z? You might go and actually try and talk to people and, you know, direct things in some way. But then at the same time, I think that through this process of us going out and occupying spaces, we are realizing the limitations of going out and occupying spaces. That there's a limitation to how will that ever go anywhere else if nothing coherent emerges? I know that was a big jumble of ideas.
I want to. I interviewed Sean KB a couple weeks ago. Now I'm going to try to release the interview on the channel in the next couple of days. And what he is saying, and it's this kind of crazy thing to say in a way, but I think it's actually right when I hear him say it. I've heard it in a variety of ways, and I used to be very reactive against it. But now I'm softening to the idea, which is that rather than trying to directly intervene politically or to put pressure on the state through protest movements, that what needs to occur is that the working class people need to rebuild civil society institutions. In other words, we need to recognize our own power as civil society, come together outside of the context of state-managed political movements, and and rebuild a less atomized political culture to start with. That would be like step one. Why don't we, you know, be independent of the progressive state's left, be independent of the progressive state's right, and try to build a civil society-based political movement by first rebuilding civil society, which has taken a tremendous blow over the last 50 years and certainly over the last 5 years with the pandemic. So that would be where I think we should start. I think we have to think that through, though. And I would hope that those kinds of organizations would be less moralistic and would be open to criticism. I know, I mean, when I interviewed Sean, I said, well, do you worry about this just becoming a subcultural scene, or in some way or another, or either becoming a subcultural scene or being reabsorbed back into the state bureaucracy through NGOs and things like that? And he said, yeah, those are both dangers. But it's a thought that I think two failed musicians advise a fledgling band on how to record their first album.
Hey, you know, speaking of musicians and albums, I have had a couple of punk rock bands get in touch with me to tell me, and I'm saying a couple, like two, to tell me that I have inspired their songs. And oh, what are they called now? Oh, I'm going to look it up. And you guys can all go listen to a song that was inspired by me. How cool. As somebody who was a punk rock kid, I just find that to be the very coolest thing. I'm no longer influencing my punk boyfriends to write songs about me, which they never did. And I'm having a political impact in some way. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, look around. There's no one. There's all you have are failed bands. There are no big megastars on the left. There's no one who's gotten there and gotten scored that, you know, studio album or major label. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right. Sorry, I should have let you finish that thought, because that is a huge issue that we're coming up against at the moment. And I'm going to come back to that. There's a lot that I want to come to in what you've just said. But I just interviewed Tamandra Harkness today for my podcast, and this is exactly what she was saying. But she's got a new book coming out, and that's, we got a problem. And I realized it, and I went, oh boy. Okay, so you talked earlier about issue-oriented protest movements, that we have this problem with kind of fragmentation. We've had this problem since the fall of the Berlin Wall, that you could no longer have a sort of mass movement. You couldn't have these, like a communist movement or a socialist movement. It was all about these single issues. What the fall of the Berlin Wall led to this fragmentation of the left into all these single issues. And I think what we're coming to now is exactly what you just said, Doug, is we are realizing the limitations of single issue mobilization. Very little can come from this. And you know, this is the two failed musicians. Yeah, I mean, we came from that milieu. We came from the milieu of the single issues, right? I was against Iraq, and so were you. And what I was for Indigenous awareness. I don't even know what the fuck that
I was
meant,
against like U.S. invasion of Iraq. I want to point that out. I was
sorry.
Not against,
yeah, you
Iraq
like,
as a nation. Oh, I know you. I knew what you
screw
meant.
Screw you, Iraq. No, yeah. You were against.
Let me go through the countries that I'm against, starting with Canada. Okay, go ahead.
Fuck you, Canada. Yeah, I misspoke. Thank you for correcting me. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, so we came from this milieu of being like, oh, and I, you know, and the punk rock scene was all about that as well. Like, I remember scoffing, like, you're like default anarchism and kind of scoffing at Marxism, knowing nothing about Marxism, dumb kid, teenager, kind of being like, oh yeah, that was authoritarian and this was all really, really bad. And we need like leaderless movements. I kind of got this like wishy-washy kind of idea of politics just from punk rock, you know? But at the same time, it was kind of like liminal and about freedom. It was some good aspects of it at the time, you know? But anyway, so we're realizing that. We're realizing that we need to move beyond that. And you put it exactly right, that we have to kind of move out into a kind of working class that's movement that sees all of these things as of a piece. So it's not like I'm against the invasion of Iraq, or I am against the deluge of Gaza. I am for environmentalism, and I am for the whales, and I am for this, but to recognize the deep interconnections between all of these issues seems like a very obvious thing to say, but it is such an important thing to build a movement around. And then you kind of framed it in the most boring way humanly possible. You said we need to rebuild civil society. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, like stop being so atomized. Go out, go bowling with other people. Have a sense of your life being extending beyond your small domain. Know people in your neighborhood and know people around the world that you meet with in the flesh. And do and set this up as something that, again, the idea of the difference between civil society and the state is that civil society, you know, that's the realm of everyday people. That's where we live our lives. We think of it often enough in terms of leisure time, right? But it wasn't always the case that it was just, oh, that's the time we go shopping. That's a complete debasement of our lives when you think of it that way. Civil society is a realm of individuals living and directing their lives and their lives together. The whole point of socialism is that all of us individuals living together are going to direct history and to work together to make our lives happen. And so rather than falling under the authority of some alienated institution or social form, which we take to be almost natural, and you know, which we're at constant war with. Civil society is a realm where people can be civil. You know, that Danny pointed this out in a speech, like, you know, feudal society, everyone's feuding. Civil society, you're civilized and polite. You treat each other well. Yeah, we need to rebuild a sense of connection to one another and outside of the domain of state authority and power. You know, leave our homes, no longer treat each other as biohazards. That's like step one. You know, try to be less atomized, and do it in a conscious way. And it's very small.
We're going to have Sublation meetups, so you can do that.
Yes, yes. This is all like part of our rebrand. This is just all our rebrand. This is, don't trust us. And this is just a rebrand. No, it's not. It's just that actually that's the weird thing that's happening. It's not just us, but like every media company right now is going, we need to get back into real life. And that's because that's actually where the power is right now, is in everyday life. People want to get out and live. And I think that's a positive first step. But yeah, we are going to have meetups in real life, hopefully. But more importantly than Sublation's meetups is the idea itself being, you know, let's try to reconnect to one another. And you can criticize our meetups and, you know, from afar. You don't have to go to them to direct tweets at us. But I have like a whole 12-minute... I know you're like, Doug, don't say it's just a rebrand. You're such an idiot. But anyway,
I know you were joking, but the thing that the reason why I mentioned that was because, I guess I'll just save this for the Patreon, but this is what's happening. And I've come to this realization that we have this meeting of the end of mass society, which hasn't really ended, but this, the, you know, mass production, all that stuff, is meeting this kind of particular and ultra personalization. And, you know, we've got these like niche podcasts and this endless self-referential, you're in your little box with your headphones on. But there is this desire to get out of that and bring the particular back out into the mass. And I'm going to talk about this in the Darned Patreon, because I think at the end of the day, we can have a revolution in the form of a bra that fits. There's my Zizekian line for you. I swear to God, I'm going to make that make sense. I'm going to make that make sense. And Doug, you didn't even listen to it or hear it.
I did. I did hear you. I heard you, but I did. Okay. Can I read my presentation to Platypus now? It's not too long.
I know. I knew that you wanted to do that. Okay. But I don't, I wondered if we should like wrap. Bring that into the Patreon,
give us
the highlights, and just know that no, I want to finish this discussion in the Patreon. I want to talk about this meeting of the personalization and mass society and how there's a kind of sublation happening. I want to come back to that. And the failed bands is a fantastic example of this. And I also want to use bras as an example as my Zizek moment. But go on, Doug. Tell me what you presented to Platypus.
I'll summarize it, and then people who want to go and pay their shiny. Uh-oh, did you leave? Oh.
No, I gave you the floor.
You gave me the floor. I'm going to, if you can give us your shekels, you can hear the fullness of this presentation. But what I am going to be talking about is how the protest movement, as it is right now, has not escaped the capitalist politics that define this moment. So, and I go paranoid with it. So I mention the foundations that are funding the organizations that called for these protests, like the Tides Foundation, which is a dark money operation for the Democratic Party. And I try to describe how it can be that the left is so captured by capitalist politics and the progressive state, even in its moment where it feels as though it's absolutely rebelling against the Democrats and absolutely breaking free and striding independently, where it still is an expression of, I think, contradictions within the state bureaucracy, the progressive capitalist state, and still an expression of the popular front, even as it tries to punish the Democrats. That's what I would say. And that's what you'll find in the parrot room. I'm going to put you back in. Wait, like this? No, like that. Should we wrap it up?
We should. And I just want to say that the band that got in touch with me is called the Femigades, and their song that was inspired by an interview of mine is called Broken Bones. And it's wonderful. It's just such a good song. It's about like the incredible frustration that you can feel in contemporary society and how they want to offer you therapy. And the singer says, I only listened to it a few times, so I don't remember all of the lyrics, but it's like, I have a right to feel this way. And it's really good. So go out and listen to that. And yes, join us in the Patreon, where we will finish this analysis. We'll delve into it. And I want to talk about exactly that this issue you talked about with failed bands, that's exactly the problem that we have now. Nobody starts a band anymore. They start a podcast, but it's the same issue. It's the same issue. If you want to start a movement, we have to contend with the intense personalization that we are dealing with and the fragmentation of politics that comes with it.
I want to point out that what Secret Agent Dan says here at the end, Matt Leck isn't saying don't critique right now, but if you want to critique, come down here and discuss it with us in person. You know, I did mention exactly literally what he said, and I just want to point out that not everyone can come there in person. And also, if your movement insists that you people accept its terms before they critique, then it's not open to critique. That is, if you have a critique that you're serious about, you may not want to go down and join the movement. Exactly. But so you should be able to express it, and they should be able to answer it without telling people not to.
I'm sympathetic to the sentiment that he's expressing, though. And I think there has to be, there can be more engagement in person with groups And there can be critique as well. That's and there yeah, can but, be wider, but wider, not wider on, discussion. Not
in, yeah, but not in an occupied Columbia University library. There can't be. Mm. Let's be real. You're not going to start rebuilding human connections in the middle of an occupation of Columbia, which is locked to the public anyway right now, and right. also where the ideological point is already determined. It's not an open space for civil, you know, connection and the overcoming of alienation. It's taking marching orders from the Tides Foundation and limiting your politics to, anyway, I'll go on and on. I'll do this in the parent room. But anyway, yeah.
We'll get it. All right, so join us, and the link is below.
Okay, so I'm going to hit the outro, which is the same as the intro.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around...